is now in session. We have three bills to consider this morning. And because of the unusual situation in which I'm the sponsor of these three bills, I will be presenting public testimony from the witness stand, or from the witness box, whatever you call it. And Chair Krieger will fill in to me as chair of the subcommittee, and then as I take my place, we'll just switch the gavel back. The first bill is House Bill 2545. Counsel, do you want to explain the bill, please?
Chair, committee members of the committee, House Bill 2545 prohibits public bodies from including attorney's fees and certain costs of labor in the fees charged to those requesting public records.
I think the way I'll proceed with my testimony first, and then I will call the proponents and call the opponents. I have probably, besides myself, about six witnesses, but I think we can do them in groups and accommodate everybody relatively quick.
Open a public hearing on House Bill 2545.
Thank you, Chair Krieger and remaining members of the committee. My name is Bob Ackerman. I'm a state representative from North Eugene, Legislative District 13. I'm here this afternoon or this morning to testify in favor of House Bill 2545, which would make certain amendments to our public records law. The most substantial one of which would prohibit a public agency from charging its legal costs as a part of the records request. I'm firmly convinced that a thriving democracy depends upon the accessibility of government records, and in fact that thought is very, very clearly stated in ORS 192.420, which provides that, quote, every person has a right to inspect any public record of a public body of this state. Under the statutory scheme, certain records are exempt and certain records are not exempt, and there are various tests to utilize as to whether those records should be disclosed to the public. I have no concern with classification of public records. Most importantly, however, a public body may establish fees reasonably calculated to reimburse it for its actual costs in making public records available. And it can also assess costs for the summarizing, compiling, or tailoring of such records, and that's all provided by statute. What's missing here is the distinct language which would allow a public body to charge its legal costs to the requestor of information. However, I have found from a personal experience, which is attached to my testimony, which has been distributed, and it's also been very apparent to me as I've talked with representatives from public agencies, that they typically do charge back legal costs to the requestor. In my particular instance, without going through a lot of detail, I don't think I have that letter here, but it's in your packet. I think I made a very narrow records request. I got about 33 plus documents. I was charged over $800, most of which was for legal fees. I did not have any prior notice of that. I was also informed that I was being charged $28 an hour for staff people to locate the file. I think the statute needs some clarification as to whether public agencies can or cannot charge legal fees back to the requestor. I have, in my discussions with various state agencies, drafted a Dash 1 amendment, which is not ready today, but will be available probably next week, which would make at least one major clarification, and that is that actual cost of labor could be charged by the public agency if the records request is voluminous. In other words, it's so broad, and this is a big criticism I heard from public agencies. They get very, very broad requests. They don't know what to do with them. So I would include that language in the Act so that the actual cost of producing voluminous records would be allowed, as would when the requestor where the request requires a summarization, compiling, or tailoring of records. In other words, extra work that has to be done by the agency. I still would retain in my amendments the prohibition against charging legal costs back to the requestor. And for those reasons, I would need a little bit more time to consider that amendment. This morning, I talked with other representatives of public agencies that had other sorts of compromises on this particular topic. So with that in mind, we will, after the public hearing and before the next session on this bill, try to work out these differences. My basic argument, however, is that legal costs in compiling records are a part of the cost of doing business of the state. And as long as the state has firmly committed in the ORS I cited to allowing public citizens to inspect and copy public records, I do not believe that they should be charged the legal costs. I do know that many agencies have complained that this is a cost, an ongoing cost for them. However, it appears to me that they have a very long-standing record of these costs and should adequately budget for them in their agency budgets rather than shifting that cost onto the public. Or to the individual requestor. I think to do that, it puts a chilling effect on the requesting and production of public records, which is contrary to the very clear statutory command here that every member of the public has an absolute right to inspect and copy public records. So with that, I'll conclude my testimony and take any questions from our committee members.
Committee members, Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Ackerman, I must say that I agree with you that sticker shock is an important consideration here, especially when someone is requesting something they think is relatively routine. Now, in your proposed amendments, I understand what you're trying to get to if they're voluminous or require summary and compilation or organization. But did you say that you will intend to leave the prohibition of charging those types of costs in your bill, or is that something that you are further considering?
What I'm clarifying is that the public agency can estimate its labor costs if they are required to produce volumes of records or tailor records or customized records or summarized records. But they have to give that estimate to the requestor first, just aside from legal fees, so that the requestor doesn't get blindsided with the big bill. In my opinion, what would happen if the request was so broad by a requestor, they knew that they had to pay, and they knew what the estimate was, it might require them either to narrow the request or withdraw the request, because lots of these requests we know are just frivolous, but yet it is their right. So yes, the actual cost, but excluding labor, would be chargeable upon proper notice under those circumstances.
Paul?
Thank you. So you do consider that you want to prohibit charging attorney time?
Yes.
And then I have a further follow-up then, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up.
What do you propose, or how would you propose to handle situations where you might have sensitive, confidential information that would need to be redacted for the protection of individuals?
Well, that would be the obligation of the agency and the obligation of the agency to seek legal advice on that topic, and they would have to bear that cost. Bear the legal costs, not the copying or compilation costs, but the legal costs of doing that.
Further follow-up, please.
Follow-up.
Thank you. And I did hear you say that you were concerned that those costs could be built in or accommodated within a current budget of an agency or other entity that this request is being made. And I'm wondering if you share the view then that there are pockets of costs that agencies can bear, sometimes very significant legal fees that are brought about as a result of these kinds of requests.
I do acknowledge there could be that unusual type of case. However, if in my dealing with the agencies on this issue, they all complain about that, but they also tell me that they keep very detailed records of the time that they spend on the records request, including legal time. So my counter-argument to that is, well, if you have this record, you should be able to you know, budget that in your agency budget, and I'm not sure that it is or isn't. I can't draw that out of the agencies just yet, but so far they have, I understand their policy is not consistent. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. Sometimes they waive it, sometimes they don't. I'm just stating this just as a more broadly based policy question. Should the public as a whole bear this cost, or should the individual requestor bear this cost? And which is at the best interest of the public?
Thank you.
Representative Groy.
I'm going to follow up on Representative Flory's question, and this is just based on my experience as a county commissioner. In regards to the cost, most of the agencies and local government entities that you deal with have an attorney on retainer, and it would not increase or decrease the cost of a public records search in that the counties or the agencies are going to spend a flat amount of money every month anyway, regardless of how much they work for the attorneys. So I always like to see attorneys work harder, so this is probably part of that. Would you agree with that, Representative Ackerman?
Chair Krieger and Representative Garrard, yes, I would. And I think it goes back to my fundamental argument, whether the attorney's on retainer or whether it should be otherwise a line item budget, I think this can be accommodated by state agencies. It must be under the statutory section I cited for public access of records.
Representative Ackerman, how would this apply to small entities, cities, some of the smaller counties that have very limited ability to absorb this type of cost?
Chair Krieger and members of the committee, that the definition of public body or public agency in this this bill would certainly include those, and my amendments would not, or my bill, or my, excuse me, my bill would not exclude smaller agencies. Now, I have talked to representatives of those smaller agencies, but I don't know what small is. Lots of them are special taxing districts. Lots of them have can charge that back to their customers or charge that back to their ratepayers. But when they say they're a small district, nobody really tells me how big is small. You know, do they have a budget of $10 million, $60 million, $90 million? I don't really know.
Okay. Representative Carrard?
Representative Ackerman, what's the time period that an entity has to respond to a request for public records? Is it 30 days?
Chair Krieger, Representative Garrard, I'm going by memory. You make the request, and depending upon whether you make the request to a state agency or a non-state agency, either it ultimately goes to the district attorney or to the attorney general for a determination as to whether the records are exempt or not or should be disclosable or not. And then I think there's a seven-day period if they are disclosable for the agency has to produce the documents. But there's a lot of lead time in there as the agency is consulting with this legal representative, the AG or the DDA. So usually it's about a 30-day downtime.
Thank you.
Any further questions?
And thank you. Just one thought now. Representative Ackerman, are you aware if there is any protocol in place where a person who makes a request is advised of a ballpark figure of what a request might cost?
Not in my experience, and I've made record requests, and I've actually litigated records requests, and I've never had a situation where the agency has come back and said, give me an estimate. They just would, I don't think I've ever been charged. The exception is one instance. But I think it's becoming more common as budgets are becoming tighter.
Further follow-up. Thank you. And public oftentimes, I think, expects to pay perhaps a per-page fee, what have you. Do you think the public is routinely advised that they may be charged for attorney time?
Chair Krieger, Representative Flores, let me understand your question. Is the question whether the public's advised of what the costs are?
To your knowledge.
To my knowledge, no. Although I am aware of instances where it has occurred. I just don't know if there's a consistent policy because there's so many different public agencies that have their different twist on this.
Thank you.
Representative Ackerman, do you feel that the public, in other words, not an attorney doing that work, but do you think that the public looks at having access to these records as exercising either a statutory or constitutional right?
Chair Krager, representative of the committee, I'm not sure I understand your question.
Well, the public, when they go in and get records, as Representative Flores says, they got to pay a fee for the paper, you know, 10 cents a page or something. But in addition to that, when you go in there, do you think there's an expectation of most citizens, if they go to the county or the state, that they're actually exercising a statutory or constitutional right to that access?
Chair Krieger, representatives and members of the committee, I think yes. I think, and I think that's fostered by the language in the statute I read in my introduction, that all members of the public have a right to copy and inspect public records. I think lay people just looking at that leads them to believe it's the policy of the state that records will be disclosed.
And in that statute, it doesn't refer to these fees being able to be collected.
Chair Krieger and representatives of the members of the committee, the Act does say that actual costs can be charged, and then labor costs can be charged if the request requires a tailoring, summarization, compilation of the record. That's what the statute says.
Yeah.
The statute doesn't directly say legal fees also may be. So I think what the agencies are doing are tucking legal fees under actual costs, okay, and that's what the public doesn't understand and doesn't expect.
Okay. Representative Greyer?
In Klamath County recently, a circuit court judge actually ruled and stopped an entity from looking at public records in regards to a Klamath County School Board issue. And the judge ruled based on a client-attorney privilege.
Mm-hmm.
Would your bill do anything to correct that problem?
Chair Krieger and Representative Girard, I think the problem was cured by the court decision. I don't think this bill can cure that problem. What probably happened in that case is that the public agency said these records are exempt because of attorney-client privilege, and they had to litigate that. This bill doesn't stop that process from occurring. I guess what I'm saying is that if records are denied the public, then there has to be a process by which we can get a court decision, and that's built in the existing statute. Nothing in my bill would change that.
Further? Okay, thank you. I guess you can come up and give the people who oppose you, give them a bad time now.
I'm going to call the proponents first. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Excuse me.
Do you want to call the
agency
first? I'm going to call the proponents first.
Yeah. Treasury, DSL. I'm going to
call the proponents first.
Oh, sorry.
Okay, that's okay.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll call next Tom Gallagher and Steve Delaney, is it? Why don't you come up together? Well, this can. Okay, the market.
I think he's a proponent.
Yeah. And this is Skip Tom. Okay, I'll let you let Mr. Gallagher go first.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Gallagher, representing the Oregon Newspaper Publishers Association. And to keep this hearing relatively short, let me just dispense with all the arguments about how vital public records are to us, how we really love this bill it's originally written, et cetera, and cut to the chase here. There is going to be some balancing here between the costs of getting public records from local government and the requests that are made. We in the newspapers in the state of Oregon and other places are constantly watching the different types of requests that go into local government for public records, and some of them can be as broad as one of the very famous cases where somebody thought that they were related to Howard Hughes and was requesting of every state that they give them all records pertaining to Howard Hughes. Those are voluminous type requests and very expensive. We think that there needs to be another look at this balancing factor between costs of the records and the public's right to get in. And I have a great deal of respect for the local government and state representatives here who are involved in that, because there can be some really expensive requests made to local government, and then there are the routine requests that go through quite easily. And the statute really doesn't separate those out very much, except to talk about the cost of copying and the cost of voluminous records and so forth. Somewhere we need to draw a balance between abuse of the public records and the public records request, and good narrow focused requests for public records, records that you really need, and the legitimate costs of government that should be covered as a cost of doing business, and those costs that are specific to those particular requests. So my suggestion is that while we in general support this bill very much as it's written, we had a chance to look at some of the draft ideas on the amendments, and we think that those may get a little bit, we'd like to discuss how narrow those exemptions would focus this. And I'm going to make a suggestion that you send the advocates for the open public records and the advocates for the local governments out to sit down and under your direction, Chair, and sit down and talk about this a little bit and see if we can apply some sort of balancing test that we put in the statute that draws a distinction between what requests, what should be paid for, and what should be part of, as you say, the normal cost of doing business. To that extent, and without any particular pride in what I've done here, I sat down this morning and tried to draft out a couple of ideas here. One of them is to have a request come in that would be out of the ordinary for some reason, the size of the request, the lack of specificity in the request, the problems of redaction, having to check for the confidentiality and to take out some of the exemption parts of the public record. And what my process would be, when you submit a record, you should get it for the cost of making the copies. I need 15 pages, 15 cents a page, thank you very much. When you get into some of these other more difficult requests, then, as the amendments say, that you would get an estimate of what it's going to cost. I almost think at one point in time that the public body can call the requester and say, look, at the way you phrase this request, what you're looking for, the way you're doing this is going to require us to incur all of these costs. And perhaps the requester can change their request. Perhaps they can narrow their request. Perhaps they can come in and inspect the records in person. There are a number of ways in which you can avoid some of the costs and charges. Or then the requester is going to know what it's going to cost to actually get there. My second step, which we would do in this work group, is to begin to sit down and see which of those costs are the normal costs of doing business, which of those costs should be assumed by local government to comply with the Public Records Act, and which are additional costs and additional burdens that are put on by the request. So let me leave it with that, Mr. Chair, that we think that this is a good bill. We think that there are very talented people sitting in back of me in this room who could rework this section of the statute with a little bit of effort, because there's a great deal of experience here, and that we should have some more specificity in the statute as to what those extraordinary costs are and how you could avoid those extraordinary costs. So I'll just leave you with copies of my conditions and thoughts this morning, and then answer any questions from the newspaper perspective that you might have.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Okay, hearing none, we'll take the next witness, Mr. Delaney.
Excuse me, Representative Ackerman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Steve Delaney. I'm the Deputy Director at the Oregon Public Employees Retirement System. Just coming to share with the committee a concern that PERS would have with regard to a very narrow legal issue with regard to the fund. Federal legislation requires that the PERS trust fund be used for the exclusive benefit of the members. As we accrue contributions and earnings into the fund, we can only expend those in an exclusive benefit to the members and to the employers that are providing information and providing the contributions on behalf of the members. PERS by rule already provides for a free copy of all the records of a member's record to them, records requested by the employer. When parties outside of either members or employers contact us for records, and they're rare, tend to be either newspapers, or recently we had a request from a retiree group. We are, again, just trying to recover the reasonable cost of producing the documentation. We provide an estimate of what it would require to produce the documents requested. We do not, in our particular case, we do not add legal costs. There have been times when we have had to inquire of the Department of Justice regarding requests from newspapers, especially when it gets into confidentiality, but we've considered that part of our administration as opposed to the cost of producing the record, which is what we will, we provide that in any estimate given to a requestor. So in my written testimony that I provided to you, where we briefly provide the statutory issues regarding the trust fund and the exclusive benefit issue, we also suggest three possible modifications to the bill that would address the issues that PERS has with regard to the trust fund. The bill could be specific to stating that this prohibition only applies to PERS members and employers, because basically we're already there. It could exclude PERS altogether because of the trust fund nature of it. Or thirdly, if there is the policy desire to provide these records to other parties, we've indicated here that general funds could be appropriated to cover those costs to ensure that the trust fund does not incur a cost outside of the exclusive benefit issue. I'm happy to answer any questions the committee may have on our concerns.
Fine. Thank you for your testimony. Questions from the committee?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Flores.
Thank you. Mr. Delaney, the administrative portion or administrative expenses that you mentioned that would cover salaries, benefits for your employees, cost of doing business in offices, in your office, what is the budget for administrative versus the benefit to the employees or to the members?
Chair Ackerman, Representative Flores, the PERS budget is $80 million for the biennium, so $40 million per year.
Okay. Follow up?
You may.
And then you're saying that your $80 million administrative budget, which covers all of those other costs, would be stretched if you were to provide the information requested?
Representative Flores, no, it's not at stretching. It's, again, it's what is the use that it has been put to. The federal legislation requires that trust fund dollars be expended exclusively for the benefit of the member. If a member requests a record, that's to their benefit. We provide that record to them for free. If a newspaper is requesting the information, that is not to the exclusive benefit of the member. And so, therefore, we recoup the reasonable cost of that, the photocopying, and if there is any staff time to collect information, that is charged to them. So, again, it's not an issue of how much. It's the issue of the purpose, the fact that there is this exclusive benefit paradigm that we have to be aware of as we expend trust fund dollars.
Thank you for the clarification.
Further questions for the committee? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony, and I'll call up the next witness, Chuck Skikoff. I've mispronounced your name, I think, but you can correct me.
You're not the first, Mr. Ackerman. My name's Charles Sheketoff.
Sheketoff, thank you.
Took me to about fourth grade to spell it. But thank you for the opportunity to be here. I am the executive director of the Oregon Center for Public Policy, and I'm here in support of the bill. I actually hope that your letter from the charging you $800 for 33 pages becomes as infamous as the stewardess who kicked Ralph Nader off a flight to come fly to Hartford, Connecticut when I was in high school, which led to the no bumping rule in the airline industry. She wasn't very smart in sending that letter. I want to share with you our perspective on this, my experience, and then have one conceptual amendment to it. Every day, Oregonians use the public records law because the general policy in this state is that you get it. And they don't know whether they're necessarily using the law. I don't know what people think about whether it's statutory or constitutional. In fact, it was only recently I looked up whether or not there was a constitutional basis for our law. But because there aren't a lot of laws in the scheme of things that say, provide this document, provide this document, provide this document. In general, people ask the government for information, they get it. Paper documents and otherwise, and things are online and put online at requests. And so there's a whole bunch of informal requests for public information happening every day. All of you have used it yourselves. And those decisions involve agencies making on a daily basis issues about sensitive and confidential information. And sometimes they make mistakes. The Department of Human Services a couple years ago had a rash of them where they put online names of people getting public benefits. And then they also once mailed out to a broad list of people involved in senior and disabled services of names of and Social Security numbers of people getting general assistance benefits. So, you know, they have to make those decisions every day about which employees within their office can see certain documents and whatnot. So to do cost shifting when they get a formal request for public information because they ran it by a lawyer is ridiculous. When I request stuff, typically from my office perspective, it's to use and research and analysis and publish the information. And so I will be upfront with you that I always make a request for a fee waiver under the statutory standard that fees can be waived if it's in the public interest to disclose it, and it follows a line of cases under the Federal Freedom of Information Act about ability to disseminate whether and a weighing test on the public interest. Those are the informal requests daily. It happens all the time, multiple times during the day. But then there's the formal request. And when do we make those? Sometimes it's when the agency wants to protect itself. I'll talk to an agency and they say, yeah, I really want to give you this, but you know what? So-and-so is going to be mad if I give this to you. They're going to think I'm favoring you. So send me a formal letter. That's a formal public record request. Sometimes I do file one when I don't get a response to the informal emails and phone calls. Hey, where's the docket? Where's the document? And so I file it. And we don't have a 10-day rule, which the Federal Freedom of Information Act has on initial response. But I file that, and now that actually gets kicked up a level within the agency. And then if I don't get a response and I debate with the agency back and forth on what's reasonable, then I just file the appeal to the Attorney General's office, and I say they violated the reasonable time. It's effectively a denial. What that forces is the AG's office to then contact the agency, and the agency say, wait a second. Have you made a decision? No. Well, you better make a decision. They write me back, the AG does, and says, your appeal is premature and therefore moot, but the agency is going to get back to you, and it forces the agency. And then last, I do a formal request when I've been denied at the informal level, and that allows them to think about it again further, talk to their in-house and AG, and the in-house attorneys and the AG, and then if I get a denial, I appeal that to the Attorney General's office, and I've been trying to think how many I've done over the last 6 years, and I think I've probably done about 24 of those, and I think I've only lost one. I think there's only one Attorney General's, a formal Attorney General's opinion on a denial from me. I think I know what the law requires, which is that it requires that most records be made public. But I do get into I share your pain, Mr. Chairman, about these exorbitant fees. One request I made to the agency a couple of years ago, about 3 years ago, the agency sent me a bill, and I made it to a high-level management person, program director at the agency, and the photocopying bill was his time in front of a photocopier. Now, I know this guy rarely uses the photocopier at the Department of Human Services, okay? And I thought that was outrageous. And they try to do that to shift and dissuade you from getting the documents. I also recently, when the Legislative Fiscal Office required all agencies to turn into them by January 14th all their budget and priority order, priority programs and priority order, I made a request to a number of state agencies to get that because we analyzed state budgets and wanted to see what the priorities were. I was most interested in the Department of Human Services. They had told me and others at a Human Service Coalition meeting information was available. They denied it. I appealed it. AG contacted and said, you better give it to them. They sent it to me, and then the agency complained at the next HISCO meeting that I had cost them money with the Attorney General's office, and it was only because they denied me access. It makes no sense. There is one, so I support the bill. I think I would be happy to participate in a work group, if possible, on how to what things ought to be in and how terms are defined for the exceptions. I fully understand the voluminous request problem, the Howard Hughes example, and less than that. But there's another impediment, cost impediment, to private citizens in getting government documents. And I'll raise this with a bit of sensitivity, but it was put into the law by people who were years ago, all of your predecessors and all of your colleagues in the current legislature's predecessors. And the law is this. If someone requests a public record from, let's say, the chair, and the chair denies it for a totally silly reason, that person has to go to court, has to get a lawyer and go to court and sue to get the document. The process is with an elected official denying it, like a county commissioner. The only recourse is the court. When it's an agency person, the recourse is you first get a first bite at the apple with the attorney general or district attorney, and that makes sense. The attorney general can say to the agency, look it, if we have to go to court, you're probably going to lose, and so we think you ought to give it to them. And I've never seen the statistics out of the AG's office, but I know from my own experience that often the appeal to the AG's office, and I'm sure at the district attorney level, results in it getting resolved favorably to both sides, and they don't end up in court. And so the problem of elected officials being able to hide, so for instance, had you made the request to a state agency, and for whatever reason, the governor had responded, you would have been forced to go into court versus go to the AG for the first bite at the apple appeal. And I think that's an undue burden on private citizens, and it's inefficient because, as I said, you know, if you have to sue, if I end up suing you for denying me, the AG may represent you, and the AG goes, Senate Representative Ackerman, why'd you deny this on this silly basis that you didn't like the color of his eyes or whatever? And they are going to have to be much more costly to go to court. So I would urge you to consider, I know it's not the main point of the bill, the exception for elected officials. I think would also instill some confidence and credibility, help instill confidence and more confidence and credibility in elected officials. I think the fact that they don't have that first bite at the sort of administrative, the AG or the district attorney appeal is troublesome.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Other questions from the committee? Yes, Representative Worth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Shelikoff, have you given any consideration or you have any idea of the potential detrimental effect this might have on local governments for recouping the cost of ballot measure 37 issues, having the archival research and everything for certain properties?
I would hope, Mr. Chair, Representative Worth, members of the committee, I would hope that in looking at the impacts of Measure 37, this would be looked at, because it does raise it to a new level as far as having to go into archives and whatnot. And the chair described in his testimony made exception for voluminous requests, maybe some language about having to go into archives and whatnot. I also think that you're not supposed to use the public records law as a way of getting around sort of formal discovery. So there's also the issue of if maybe that could get dealt with one, what's the process at the local government level? And I am not a Measure 37 expert by no means, okay? But I would think that if there's sort of a process, once a process is instigated at the local level, then you could sort of say, well, that's a part of the discovery process in this decision at the local level, maybe. I don't know. But I would bring it up to the people studying Measure 37. I think it's a very valid concern, having to deal with archives. I've never had to have made a request to a state agency where stuff is in the archives building. I've never, said, go to the archives building and find it for me. They said, you can go to the archives building and find it. So it may be something about having to deal with that, about statutes, about if something is officially in archives, who bears the burden of searching it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Further questions from the committee? Seeing none, thank you again for your testimony. Before I call up the next witness, I just want to give you the benefit of my thinking right now in terms of forming a work group to consider some of the variations that we've talked about here today. I think that group should consist of representatives of the small special districts, the municipal districts such as the cities and counties. I would suggest Mr. Gallagher for the private requestors, and I would need a volunteer for, I'd like to have a component for a representative of state agencies. So that's my thinking right now. You might want to relate to that in your testimony as to the other witnesses that will be testifying this morning. But that's the intention of the chair at this time. If we can refine that group or expand it, I try to draw out what I thought were the representative interests. So with that in mind, I'll call Jeanette Holman and Kate Richardson.
There you go, Kate.
Okay. proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Jeanette Holman, the Assistant Director for Administration and Finance at the Department of State Lands. We've been asked to give you some representative information for state agencies about the effects of this bill potentially on state agencies. So I'm drawing from our experience at the Department of State Lands, and I've given you written testimony, but I'd like to hit a few highlights. The Department of State Lands is a medium-sized agency. We have about 80 permanent or full-time employees, and it's a constitutional body headed that is the administrative arm for the State Land Board, consisting of the governor, the treasurer, and the secretary of state. Our primary duty is to manage state lands, state trust lands, for the benefit of the Common School Fund, raising money for that fund. We also have a number of other programs, including operating the state's removal field permitting program, the unclaimed property program, and we also administer estates for those who die without apparent known heirs or intestate. We get requests for public records under all of our programs, but most of the requests come under our land management program or under the removal field permitting program. This bill, as you know, would limit our ability to charge for legal costs and staff time. We generally provide between 800 and 1,000 copies of public records a month. Once or twice each biennium, we get a large request that involves major time and expense, and I've given you a copy of an invoice for that, for one of those, where we were asked for almost 30,000 copies were made from 652 different files. It required us to hire a temporary worker for 5 months, whose time was fully devoted to that task. In addition, regular DSL staff were involved, including working overtime and on weekends. That staff time was not billed to this request because the person who did it was a manager on a salary basis and wasn't eligible for overtime. So we didn't include that portion of the staff time in the request. Generally, we give any person requesting public records, if it's a large request, an estimate of how much it would cost. We feel this is valuable for a number of reasons. First of all, it gives them a heads up of what it might cost to get those records. It also tends to help them think about ways to narrow their request or focus it, and discourages fishing expeditions across, you know, for all of your records for the past 10 years on a particular subject. And we have actually had record requests to provide records, all of our records, not just in the past 10 years, but for since we became an agency, which was 1859. So we have, primarily because of the huge requests that we occasionally get, we have some concerns with the bill. We anticipate that should this bill pass, we will have an increase in the number of large requests we get if we cannot include staff time as part of the cost of providing those records. This would require money to be taken out of the Common School Fund revenue streams and paid for this cost rather than going into the Common School Fund, resulting in reduced revenue to a Common School Fund. Allowing the charges only when the request is for public records in manner different from the manner the agency maintains the records doesn't alleviate the staff impact when the request is for a broad, unfocused set of records. The request is technically for a set of records that we name in the way we maintain them, but because of the volume, it's a huge task to go through each one, and we do have to go through every file, redacting confidential information. And this is an issue that's becoming more and more important, that we're very careful about that check, as there are more and more laws in place restricting the confidentiality or the disclosure of confidentiality information about social security numbers and stuff like that. Finally, we too are a trust fund agency, and we have a fiduciary duty to the Common School Fund. And that, what that means is when we get one of these huge requests, we have to weigh the trust responsibility to that Common School Fund against the cost of providing those records. And that's usually how we decide that we need to charge a person when it's a huge request, such as the one that I gave you an example of. We would be more than happy to work with you. We have some suggestions requiring, which most of these have been tossed around a little bit this morning already, requiring agencies to provide a written estimate of a cost prior to providing the records for any anything above a certain dollar amount. Establish a de minimis number of records that will be provided without charge, and then allow the agency to charge for staff time beyond that. Or again, Steve mentioned the possibility, although I frankly think it's a pretty low possibility, of getting general fund monies to pay for these costs if necessary. And I'd be glad to answer questions if you have any. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Questions, Representative Garrard?
I noticed that in your invoice that the largest amount of money as part of that invoice was copying the documents, locating and copying. I'm wondering, why does the responsibility of making the copies fall to the public body?
Mr. Chair, Representative Garrard, we have had problems with files walking away or documents from files walking away from the office, and so we feel like we really need to be there when they're being copied or gone through, at least one staff person.
To follow?
Yes, you may.
What if you were only required to give one copy to the individual per request?
We would do that without charge.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you for your testimony. next witness.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Kate Richardson, Chief of Staff for the Oregon State Treasury. We are also a small agency and smaller than Department of State Lands, but we do have some unique situations. Although this would have a fiscal impact on us, indeed, we do have some other concerns on public policy for public policy reasons. We receive a wide variety of types of public record requests and from many different types of requesters. Some are relatively small. Some are regular quarterly requests. Some are large one-time requests. Some come in a flurry all at once. The requesters may be members of the public, including non-Oregonians, the media, researchers, international law firms, national labor organizations, or private businesses, including many that are out of state. As provided by law and with the guidance of the Attorney General's Public Record Manual, on which we rely very regularly and which provides very good guidance for us, the Treasury has developed a policy and fee schedule for filling public record requests. The policy expressly limits recovery to actual costs, and it breaks down labor, legal costs, and copying and postage and related costs. For large requests requiring a great deal of staff or legal time, especially those that are made by out-of-state requesters, prepayment of a deposit may be required. Requesting. The Treasury doesn't charge every requester. We make very liberal use of the fee waiver and reduction provisions in the current law. Using that public interest balancing test, we don't charge for probably most of our requests, including de minimis requests, many media requests, and most Oregon citizen requests, but we get very few of those. The Treasury is a highly sophisticated operation with a great number of relationships with private enterprises, from financial institutions such as banks and credit unions to private equity investment firms, emerging growth businesses, to real estate investment trusts. Those public-private relationships lead to many and sometimes tricky public record request situations. Many, in fact, probably most, record requests received by the Oregon State Treasury come from out-of-state private businesses that gather information, such as investment data, then resell the information directly or through the business's services. Some of these businesses are reputable, others are not. Other requests have come from large law firms representing clients involved in unrelated litigation with business or properties with which Treasury does business. The law firms use Oregon's public records laws to obtain documents and information for use in litigated litigation matters that are unrelated to the state. Similarly, other organizations such as national labor unions use our and other states' public records laws to gather information on different hotel properties, for instance, in which we may have a tangential investment interest, but they're gathering the information for their own organization's use in a matter unrelated to us. Because of the complexity of Treasury's business dealings, many public record requests, especially in the area of private equity investment, raise legal questions or require the assistance of counsel. A number of public record exemptions necessarily apply to many of the state's financial transactions, and some of those exemptions, such as the exemption for trade secrets, are not simple or easy to determine. The AG's public record manual makes clear that not all legal costs related to public record requests are recoverable, and we have limited our charges only to those allowed. We view the recoverable legal costs as another form of labor costs because legal counsel's expertise is necessary to fulfill the request. To my knowledge, and certainly since I've been there for 4 years, the Treasurer's Office has never sustained a challenge to any denial or fee waiver, nor have we experienced complaints over our fee structure. The fee structure has also been a tool to weed out the occasional frivolous request or the repeated nuisance request. One regular requester has a national reputation among public institutional investors for his very wide-ranging and sometimes bizarre requests for investment information. Requiring an upfront deposit has diminished the burden on the agency by reducing the frequency of his requests. He does pay it once in a while. Usually he doesn't, and then he'll just wait another few months and send another large request. Further, the fee structure can be a tool to negotiate the scope of a request. Requesters often ask for a great deal of information, and the fee schedule becomes a method of prioritization that benefits both the requester and the agency. Without the incentive of cost control, some requesters will not be motivated to keep their requests narrowly tailored and specific, and we won't have any way to stop them. For instance, this requester that comes regularly requests a broad spectrum of our investment information, and we have thousands and thousands and thousands of investments. We would have to hire more staff just to answer that particular request. The Treasury is a fee-for-service agency that requires no general fund dollars, and the agency's costs, including legal costs, are directly supported by trust funds and other dedicated funds. The Treasurer is concerned about the public policy of using Oregon taxpayer dollars and Oregon trust funds to effectively subsidize out-of-state private business by allowing those businesses and organizations to get for free what they once willingly paid for. Although the impact, fiscal or otherwise, in the Treasury may appear minor compared with other agencies, local governments, school districts, and many other public bodies to which this bill applies, it does make a difference to our small agency. Because of the unpredictable nature of public record requests, the irregularities of timing and of size, on occasion we may hire temporary help to fill the public record requests. This bill would remove that flexibility, creating additional costs to the agency and delay in response time. Additionally, we expect an increase in frequency and scope of requests once the cost recovery provisions are removed. I can tell you that on my budget, especially with a 10% reduction, we could not sustain this burden without negatively impacting other program areas. Fulfilling public records requests does bear a cost. The question is, who bears that cost? Current law recognizes that a one-size-fits-all rule is too blunt a tool for the myriad situations in which public record requests arise. The present statutes reflect the legislature's public policy of fairness by instituting a finer tool, a balancing test to determine where the cost should lie in varying circumstances. Consistent with the spirit of the law, the Oregon State Treasury policy has struck a reasonable balance among the sometimes competing interests in a way that provides access to public information, yet protects the state's business interests and its trust funds from outside costs and exploitation. We ask that you continue that sound public policy by maintaining the current statute without amendment as proposed by House Bill 2545. And I do want to make a special plug for the Attorney General's Public Records Manual, and that is updated with every legislative session, and it gives much guidance in how to apply waivers, how to recover for legal costs or not, and we use that as a regular tool.
Thank you for your testimony. Questions? Representative Garrard.
I'd like both of you to answer this question, if you could, for me. In what form are your responses to a public record request?
Mr. Chair, Representative Garrard, are you meaning in what format, such as paper or
piece of paper? Can you, are you permitted to email back that kind of a?
Mr. Chair, Representative Garrard, we respond electronically as much as we can, because that does reduce the cost for the agency and also for the requester. However, much of our information has commingled confidential or trade secret information that we are not able to segregate, and so in those times we will do a paper request. We always give an estimate up front.
Mr. Chair, Representative Garrard, we also would respond electronically whenever we could. As you know or may not know, most of our permits are now online. People can look on their online at our website to look at their permits in the process. But unfortunately, most of the public records requests are for information in our paper files that hasn't ever been put online or anything so far. So those, again, we do have to check to redact any confidential information, and then we provide it in paper format.
Thank you. Follow-up? Yeah. One last follow-up. I've been a public official now for 10 years. My reaction to any type of a request on public records has always been, oh, no. Actually, it's another word, but I won't use that. Nobody likes public records requests that are in the public. What is your agency's reactions when you get a public records request? Is it, let's give this guy a hard time as long as we can? Boy, I don't like these things. What's the general attitude? What kind of a priority do you give on?
Mr. Chair, Representative Garrard, actually, this in this Treasurer's administration, at least, and that's the only one I can really speak to. Our policy is that is a statutory right that the public has, and we don't usually have an oh no reaction. We've been trying to move to post more and more public information. Our agency has actually not been one that was been greatly in the public eye in the past, but it has become so in recent years, and we've been trying to post more information regularly on our website to provide it to the public. The oh no reactions in our situation come from very often well-known private individuals, out-of-state requesters that are either trying to work counter to the state's business interests by we're trying to work out an investment deal, and they're counter to our interests and trying to use the public records law to get as much information to put the state at a disadvantage, or are so large and bizarre that they just detract the staff from its core mission to Oregonians.
Mr. Chair, Representative Garrard, I would say that most of ours are just a routine part of business. The oh-nos come when we get the request for 655 records, and we know that that's going to severely interrupt work from our regular staff. I would say the other kind of oh no is when we get one that we don't know whether we can release it or not, and that means that we have to ask the AG whether this is something to release or not. We don't charge legal time for that, because it's an answer that we figure in the course of doing our business we have to know the answer to anyway. But those would be our two oh no's.
And one last follow here. If you had a non-oh no and an oh no that you were responding to with the same personnel, would the charges be the same?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gore, we have that situation regularly. We're very careful not to arbitrarily apply fees. We use the public interest balancing test. And specific when we are thinking public interest, we are looking to Oregonians' public interest first. I mean, there is the broader national, you know, issues of national concern as well. And to that, we rarely charge for media requests. There are times when we have negotiated for a very large request. Most recently on the Diana Goldschmidt incident with media, where they want a lot of information in a very short time period, and we've negotiated a way to get that information to them with a minimal charge or a reduction in charge. But when we look at those, we always apply the public interest balancing test.
Mr. Chair,
thank
Representative.
You. I'm going to have to conclude your testimony now. We have two more bills to get out this morning. I do want to say your testimony does indicate that you know, that there is a balancing test. I think perhaps it's an inconsistent test, agency versus agency, or through agencies, and perhaps a work group can address some of those things to make it more standardized, and that's something we'll talk about. But I do appreciate your testimony. I think you can bring that out very well. Thank you very much. Next two witnesses, Paul Schneider and Christy Monson. While you're taking your seats, I mentioned, of course, that we're going to form a work group. I got a note from Brad Swank representing the court system, and he indicated that their court system gets a lot of requests from persons that are incarcerated, so that's also sort of a specialization of record requests. So he will be included within a work group. Just wanted to make that announcement. Who wishes to go first may go first.
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Christy Munson. I'm counsel for the League of Oregon Cities, representing 240 cities throughout the state of Oregon. I wanted to thank you for the opportunity to testify today and thank the chair especially for his graciousness in listening to us for the last 3 weeks in devising some kind of compromise and some language to meet his needs for this bill. So very much appreciate that. Before I get started, I wanted to answer a couple questions that were presented by the former testimony. The most interesting one was posed by the chair. How small is small for a government agency? I believe cities are probably the proper person to talk about this. For one example, I give you the city of Waterloo. Less than one FTE managing that city. No bathroom in the city hall. You have to go across the street to go to the bathroom. And when I visited them, their biggest concern was not how they could fix the dam near their area, but they just wanted an alarm system in case it broke. So that's how small is small for our cities. A third of our cities don't have any regularly retained legal counsel. And so when they have significant public records requests, they need to go out and find somebody to help them with that. That's how small is small. And so thank you for posing that question. The other question I asked was the oh no question I heard asked. And I'll tell you how cities deal with that. If you look on the third page of my testimony, I submitted a newsletter that we regularly train our cities on public meetings law. I do the training and so do others. And the second paragraph you'll see our recommended approach is you have nothing to hide. Even if there is an exception in the public meetings law, first ask yourself, why not disclose? In the public interest, in the long term, politically and legally, it's probably going to be better for you to ask that question first. If there's federal law, we'll talk about later, or other state privacy laws, you cannot disclose. But the first question to ask is why not? We're an open government. Having addressed those really quickly, I'll just go through my testimony. And
yes, you can summarize that because we have two more bills, and your interest will be incorporated within the work group because we won't go to work session today. So
thank you.
I know we talked about that.
2 minutes, Representative Ackerman.
Yes, I appreciate that.
Kind of records we have, personal, medical information, family leave claims, development and land sale negotiation contracts, extremely private, confidential information that we need to be able to have an attorney look at to redact. And if we do not, we will be liable by third-party claims and may be violating some federal laws. State of the law right now is to maintain integrity of our public records, make sure they don't get damaged, and maintain private and confidential matters and prevent interference with our records custodians. We need to have some kind of ability to charge. That fee is established through law, an ordinance, or a rule, so we don't willy-nilly establish these fees. We can't. And lastly, we haven't heard from the proponents of this bill at all that cities are posing a problem. I think by and large, our 240 cities, small or big, are very good spirited in public records law and do their best to abide by it. And thank you for the opportunity to sit on the work group, Chair Ackerman.
Thank you very much, and I appreciate you summarizing your testimony. Mr. Schneider?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, members of the subcommittee, I'm Paul Snyder, representing the Association of Oregon Counties. I would like to just emphasize a couple of points that have been made because I think they're important to the outcome of this issue, and that is that there is a financial consideration that must be borne by someone, and there is a positive effect in being able to have a requester of public records focus that person's attention on the kinds of records the person really needs or really wants. And if there is no financial interest in that outcome, then there's really no great motivation on the part of the requester to narrow the request. And I think the narrowing of the request reduces the cost for everybody involved, if it can be done that way. And there's another aspect, Mr. Chair, as well that I'd like to emphasize, and that for local governments, including cities and counties, the credibility and customer service are very important to us. And we're very close to the people that we serve, and close physically and close in terms of their ability to raise issues with us and the need for us to be responsible and responsive to the needs that they raise. So in terms of costs that are de minimis to the local government, I think it's safe to say that firstly all local governments don't charge. But if we get into higher costs and the need for redaction and things like that that we've discussed, then there's got to be a balance. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Are there questions from the committee?
Chair.
Yes, Representative Worth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have the same question I asked Mr. Shedekoff earlier. Is what's the potential cost impact of this bill to local governments in terms of the Measure 37 type of research that might potentially come down the pike at some point?
Chair Ackerman, Representative Worth, it's impossible to know exactly who's going to be requesting and what kind of request they're going to make, but as far as cost, we have found when we're in litigation that trial attorneys are using this instead of going through discovery, and so they are trying to get some information, which is their right as a citizen, but it entails that balancing of private interest versus public good, and Measure 37 is exactly that kind of scenario where we expect that.
Thank you.
Chair, question. Representative Worth, in addition, I think the archival aspects of Measure 37 are going to be a challenge to everybody because those are the kinds of records that are important to the outcome of Measure 37 claims, and yet they're not in the kind of form or format that people are going to be able to answer questions that relate to that very easily.
Fine, thank you. Further questions? Very good. Thank you for your testimony, and I think in filling out the work group, I will contact a representative of DAS. I've talked with one of the representatives this week on this bill, so I think that would pretty much fill it out. I'll take the initiative of setting the meeting and contacting the interested parties. With that, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2555 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2557.
How many people we got on this one?
The committee, once again, my name is Bob Ackerman. I'm a state representative from North Eugene, representing House District 13. My testimony will be very short. I don't believe there's any opposition to this bill this morning, and I think a representative of the Oregon State Bar will follow me as a proponent. The probate process, of course, is a method by which the assets of the deceased are used to pay outstanding claims of creditors and ultimately for distribution among heirs or devisees if the will is involved. Under Oregon law, we have had the opportunity to commence small estate proceedings to minimize the costs of probate proceedings in small types of estates. The current total value for the small estate administration is assets of $140,000 or less as a cap. This bill raises the limit to $200,000 to accommodate the inflation, particularly with respect to real estate prices. I've been contacted by a number of lawyers with respect to this, and it did call my attention to the fact that with the appreciation of real estate values, it's probably best now to raise the threshold to some extent so that more small states can qualify for the small state administration. The value of small state administration is essentially that the process is much more quick than a formal probate. It usually takes maybe 4 months to close. There's less formalities involved. However, the rights of creditors and the rights of heirs and devisees are amply protected. Likewise, in my experience, the legal fees that are charged for small estate proceedings would probably be 20% of that of a formal probate proceeding, because of the formal probate proceeding, just by definition, takes a longer time and has more legal requirements, which I can explain if that's basically an issue. This bill, therefore, does not create any great new law, allows us more estates to qualify for small estate administration, which is a savings to the estate and ultimately produces perhaps a greater distribution to creditors and greater distribution to the heirs and devisees. So with that, I will conclude my testimony and take questions from the committee.
Committee members? The committee's going to let you off easy.
Hey, thank you.
I think they got it.
Yeah. You need to pack it up there with you.
I just have one witness signed up, Mr. Gibbs. Mr. Gibb, thank you for being here this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
State your name and occupation for the record, please.
Yes. Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, I'm Ryan Gibb. I'm an attorney in private practice here in Salem. I'm a member of the Elder Law Section of the Oregon State Bar, and I'm the chair of the Legislative Subcommittee of the Elder Law Section, and I'm here this morning on behalf of Elder Law Practitioners and the Elder Law Section in support of House Bill 2547. Again, I don't wish to repeat the testimony that you have provided, except to say that there are a number of estates which would benefit from this amendment to ORS 114.515. It is not uncommon for an estate to consist of really nothing more than maybe mom or dad's house, but really no other assets. Requiring a formal probate proceeding for one piece of property, piece of real estate, really is not cost effective. There's generally little cash that is available to initiate the probate and cover those upfront costs. A small estate has significantly less expense, especially upfront. The real estate can be sold, the creditors paid, and then the remaining estate distributed in a much more efficient fashion. $90,000 is a fairly low level for a small estate when it comes to real property. Increasing that to $150,000 recognizes the increases that have come about in real estate prices and makes that a much more realistic level. We, as elder law practitioners, we appreciate this proposed amendment, and I do urge the committee to move this on with the due pass recommendation.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Are there questions from the committee? Our state specialist, Representative Flores.
Much credit, Mr. Chair. Thank you. But perhaps my question is of you or Mr. Gibbs, and I noticed that you did not touch the issue of the requirement of increasing the filing fee for a small estate affidavit, as that component is addressed in the statute. So if that is not something that you envision increasing the filing fee.
That's correct.
And oftentimes, follow up, Mr. Chair, oftentimes filing fees are based in a full probate on levels and increments of the value of the estate. And so we're not going to go there. We're just going to leave.
I didn't anticipate that. And it is, let me just refresh my memory, perhaps, by asking a witness a question. Is a small estate filing fee set by statute or set by the court?
Chair and members of the committee, I do believe that there's a statutory fee which is somewhat less than what is actually charged by most courts. I believe most courts incorporate a fee in addition to that, as they do with a lot of the different filing fees. In general, I believe most county courts charge an $85 filing fee for a small estate. If the small estate is, or if the estate is $150,000, for example, the full probate price would, I believe, be $301 for the filing fee. A small estate fee would be $85 for the filing fee.
Thank you. I guess we're not touching the filing fee in this bill. I didn't anticipate that and did not anticipate your question.
And of that filing fee, part of it is a state-borne cost or a state-mandated cost.
Right. I mean, if it becomes an issue, we could always deal with it on the Senate side and bring it back. I'll take a look at that.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Flores, if I might, this will also reduce the burden on the courts. So it reflects the reduced burden that the court has to face when you have a small estate versus a full probate.
I can state with some clarity that our probate department is over 2 weeks behind or more on processing formal estate probate matters, whereas a small estate process is much more expedient. And that does save a lot of time, particularly when creditors need to get paid and heirs are waiting for distributions. Okay. Further questions from the committee? Seeing none, I thank you for your participation this morning.
Thank you very much,
thank
Chair.
You. Any other persons here to testify on House Bill 2547? Seeing none, then I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2547 and open a work session on House Bill 2547. I'll make the motion to refer House Bill 2547 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Discussion from the committee. Seeing none, clerk may call the roll.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Gerard?
Aye.
Representative Wirth?
Aye.
Chair Ackerman?
House Bill 2547 will be forwarded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation, and I will be the carrier. We'll close the work session on House Bill 2547 and open the work session on open the public hearing on House Bill 2548. I'll relinquish the gavel one more time to our chair. Chair Krieger and members of the committee, once again, my name is Bob Ackerman, State Representative for North Eugene, representing House District 13. The purpose of House Bill 2548 is to raise the mandatory arbitration limits in circuit court cases from $25,000 to $50,000. I want to spend a couple of minutes with you working through the arbitration proceeding. This is called court-annexed arbitration. Right now, as I said, mandatory arbitration is required in all claims less than $25,000. Judicial districts may raise the rate to $50,000, and many have, some have not. In addition, mandatory arbitration, again, is required in domestic relations cases where the only issue is a division of property between the parties. So in our domestic cases, if it's a question of spousal support or a question of child custody, it doesn't go to arbitration. It goes into a circuit court trial with a circuit court judge. I have participated in the arbitration proceedings I'm speaking of both as a litigant or representing litigants, as an attorney, and as an arbitrator. The arbitrators are chosen by a lot from a pre-selected list of arbitrators that qualify to rule on these particular types of cases. All of this is done under court direction. An arbitration award may be appealed to circuit court. The party filing an appeal to circuit court in a money claim who does not improve its position is liable for attorney's fees expended by the other party for the appeal. This has a strong deterrent effect and usually facilitates the settlements of claims. I've tried to gather statistics from a variety of judicial districts, and I find once again, as you get into public records, they keep records differently, and there's not a lot of standardization. But I think my point is there's a general success rate, as I computed, of about 80%. That means that about 100% of all claims that go to arbitration, only about 20% are ultimately appealed to circuit court for a jury trial. I think that's a system which yields a great deal of success and which should be encouraged, and should be encouraged by raising the limit to the $50,000 threshold. The arbitration of these disputes is a efficient way to litigate claims. Arbitrators are attorneys experienced in this field and are chosen by the respective parties. Basically, what happens is that each party is required, under most circumstances, to advance about $300 for the arbitration fee. So the arbitrator has $600 to bill with respect to his or her time. If there's an overage, of course, it would be billed. There's reciprocal discovery, which means each party has to disclose to the other the documents they intend to produce at the time of the hearing. There's also plans can be made to hear witnesses' testimony by telephone, which is very, very convenient. I think the most important feature of these cases is particularly in your claims for medical injuries, usually motor vehicle accidents. In most cases, you have to have some medical record of what the injuries are and some medical records to the extent of injuries. In a normal, full-blown court trial case, you would have to retain the doctor to come to court, or retain the doctor to take a deposition, and they're entitled to charge professional fees. I've rarely spent less than $2,000 on either getting a doctor's deposition or getting a doctor to testify in court. I've had some physicians tell me they will not come to court and testify, and will not prepare a case for you, the medical side, unless you pay them $3,500 or more up front. So this means a lot of the low-end cases are just too expensive to go to regular circuit court and litigate in that fashion. What happens in the arbitration proceedings, they can submit a medical report, they can submit their charts, they can submit their bills, and that is sufficient to constitute their testimony. So you get by with just a few basic records and don't have to bear the expense of bringing a medical expert into the hearing process. And once again, that's a great economy for cases that are of relatively low value. The increase in the jurisdictional limit will also result in a saving of judicial resources. In some counties that I have mentioned that have, say, 40 or 50 arbitrations a year, you might easily conclude that each arbitration takes less than a day. However, if it was a circuit court case, each arbitration or each similar case would take 2 or 3 days of court time because of the formalities in picking a jury, the fact that you have to make more elaborate opening statements and closing statements, and because of the formalities with respect to the receipt of testimony before a jury, it just takes about 2 or 3 times as long to take a case to circuit court as it does to arbitration. I think I've mentioned a few instances to some of you of one of my last arbitration cases I had, which was a motor vehicle accident, and we completed the entire hearing in less than 1 hour. Because we had some reciprocal discovery, we had all our documents together, we had an experienced arbitrator, we could go in, the arbitrator could narrow in on the issues, and it's just a great way to litigate these cases and these particular issues. And likewise, as our judicial system is a product of our state budget, and it is under severe restrictions too. You might remember that a year or so ago, our court systems were back onto a four-day week. I think it's important to know that our courts could go down to a 3-day week or a 2-day week in the arbitration process, because the clerks are still there to process the arbitration papers. The arbitration process would still work. We would still get cases litigated. So I think that argues strongly for the proposition that the jurisdiction should be raised from $25,000 to $50,000. And keeping in mind it's a narrow range of cases that goes here, but they are significant to the litigants, and they are significant to the public to save the costs, which I think this bill would achieve. So I'll take questions from the committee.
I think you're the expert.
Excuse me?
I think you're the expert.
On this issue.
Okay. Anyone else wishing to testify on House Bill 2548? Hearing none, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2548 and open the work session on House Bill 2548. And I will move that House Bill 2548 be forwarded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion from the committee?
Mr. Chair, I would just comment that while your example of a one-hour arbitration hearing is probably one of the greatest successes known to man, I've also been involved in arbitration hearings where they've been long and protracted. So
I have, too, and I just want to set that as an example. Some of the long and protracted ones here would be their domestic relations cases, even though there's not custody or support involved. There could be intricate questions regarding a division of property, valuation of property, and domestic relations, as you know, representative, is an entirely different animal.
It is.
Okay. I appreciate your comment, however. Further discussion from the committee? All right. I may call the roll for a vote, please.
Mm-hmm. Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Garrard?
Aye.
Representative Wirth?
Aye.
Chair Ackerman?
Aye. House Bill 2545 then is forwarded to the full committee for the due pass recommendation. The work session on that bill is closed. Further business before the committee?
Mr. Chair, I'd just like to make a request that that we get copies of the SMS at each meeting on those measures to be considered.
Okay.
On those dates.
Right. Your request is noted.
Thank you.
Representative, further discussions from the committee? Hearing none, we will be adjourned.
That's state administration's responsibility.